For those people who haven't made this session, what would you tell them that was useful about looking through the dissertations? Any points? Was it useful?
Yeah, for me, very, very much of the first thing was looking at the overall structure, and I'm sure it will vary, but I made a note of roughly the page numbers, the introduction, 7 pages, and literature, the fact that somebody's got introduction, then literature review, research design, data analysis, and then conclusion. I'm sure they all vary, I haven't looked at them all, but it gives me a bit of an idea of what a dissertation is, because up until that point, I'm not really sure at all.
Yeah.
And that can help me in advance by understanding what I need to prepare for. And getting a rough idea about the length of each section. I haven't looked at the other ones, but then that gives me an idea of the balance, the overall balance of the argument, and I imagine basically the structure helps. And
yeah.
Also, I hope maybe at some point, once I really understand what I'm going to study, that I'm looking at those or some others, maybe just some PhDs in my plan, I can not steal, but get some ideas from their at the back for the references.
Definitely.
I found
references,
searching
about
Athens very difficult. I probably wasn't doing it right, but I found it very difficult. Mm-hmm. Okay, in papers. So good idea of who the key people are in the various areas. So hopefully if I can find something that's a bit closer to what I want to do.
Yeah, and that's a good point to start. I mean, as I keep saying, it's a messy circular process. So starting out with trying to get an idea what one vaguely looks like. But each of these dissertations does have a different structure. So once you've really decided your topic, and even, once you have your data, then finding dissertations that are closer to your topic and seeing how they are structured differently, what their analytical framework is. And your tutor should be able to help you with that as well, make suggestions. And I am trying to get my MA students. Mariana is actually really good about emailing her dissertation out to other students who are doing blogging. So, even contacting fellow students who finish. Yes, and so all these dissertations will be in the library. PhDs are also in the library, and that's a good point as well. Finding something that's on your topic, they're all in the library catalog, so it will save you time on references. The PhDs you have to request because they're down in a vault somewhere, locked away. So it's a little bit more hassle. But these are, I think they're on the second level, just on the shelves. You can access them anytime. Okay, any other things that you found interesting or surprising? Or
they do footnotes, don't they, they don't use the whole code and reference things, don't they? They use footnotes instead. Well, this one has.
Instead of references?
Instead of
end references.
Yeah, instead of end references. But it's just to do with the length, doesn't it, really?
I don't know. I mean, I would have thought on the whole we would. I think we generally encourage people to use the Harvard system and something like it, and end references rather than footnotes. Mm.
I find footnotes a bit distracting, to be honest. I'd rather have it in the text.
They can have a funny relationship with the text as well. Yeah, I mean, it can mean it's a bit of uncertainty about what you're trying to say, actually, and you've got all this stuff that you can't quite say, so you put it at the bottom of the page. I mean,
and it interrupts.
It's quite a good discipline not to have footnotes.
It interrupts my reading, thing. I'll be trying to really, really engage with what you're trying to say, and then I have to stop mid-paragraph and read the footnotes. So I find it, it's a distraction.
You quite often find now that referee journals and book editors discourage footnotes, actually.
Although they're useful with hyperlinking with an electronic document, such as the Wikipedia type thing, because Wikipedia might be junk, but the footnote quickly takes you to a paper, which might not be.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, dissertations are a genre unto themselves. One might say a rather peculiar genre. So, yeah.
Yeah, myself, I think if you look at I've looked through two of them, and one is having 6 chapters, another is having 3, and then is having 5 or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And when I went through with Neil, he suggested 5 to me as well. And I was trying to get my head around it. When and where and what time do you use 5, 3 or
This one's seven. This one's got eight.
That one's got eight.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it depends on your topic and your data. I mean, generally, we on the media MA say your data analysis should be about half the dissertation. And you can divide that up how you want to. You could, it could be in separate chapters, or it could be one big 10,000 word chapter, or if you're doing a report, a 5,000 word chapter. So, you know, if your data is, you know, really kind of distinct topics or distinct methods, or, you know, you have some reason to divide it into chapters, then you might have three chapters versus one chapter. So that's a big part of it. But there are some things that need to be there, and Andrew will be going through the kind of different structures of dissertations and what needs to be there.
So is there any particular structure for...
Andrew's going to cover that. And we've got on your do's and don'ts. I emailed the supervisors on both MAs for ideas for do's and don'ts, and that's how I came up with this sheet. And there's a general structure on there as well to give you guidance. But ultimately, that's the part of the role of your supervisor as well. Anything about how the data is handled? Because that's often a hard thing to know. What do you do with images? What do you do with quotations from your respondents? What do you do with graphs? Do you notice anything?
Is that like interview transcripts or something? Or academic quotes?
Academic quotes. Yeah. I assume so.
Yeah.
I don't think a normal person needs it as well.
That's sort of language, no.
No, I don't know what the words
mean. Yeah, that's always a bit difficult as well, whether to use a sort of academic quote indented as a block quote, or whether to use a much briefer one that's incorporated into a sentence, or whether to paraphrase them. There's those decisions as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, I wouldn't use... You do see dissertations that have too many academic quotes in them, you know, and you think the whole thing looks like just this kind of confection of other people's bits of writing with little lines of commentary in between. So you can overdo the quotations, I think. I think they have to earn their keep. There's only any point in having it there if it's really important for your argument. I mean, other people you can summarise.
Now, that's where I really struggle with my essays. I haven't had the feedback yet, but I'm usually quite good at talking too much and forming opinions. But when I got to the point where I knew what I wanted to say, but I started doubting myself and thinking, oh, I can't say this without referencing something. And then I'd say something else, and sometimes I'd be on one sentence thinking, oh, I've got to find something to back this up. It wasn't necessarily opinion, but I almost felt like I constantly needed to say where it came from.
Yeah.
Even if I was talking about the history of ICT in education,
yeah.
I thought, okay, well, we've always had ICT in education, things such as overhead projectors, and I thought, I need to back that up. I need to find some reference where I can say that we have used overhead projectors. And then I'm searching all on Google Scholar, etc., to find an academic paper to prove that we've... And that was killing me. I was going one sentence at a time. Because reading some of the papers, it did look like that, even in some of the academic papers, it almost looked, especially in literary review, that there were every paragraph had three different... references.
Well, having a citation is a bit different. I mean, having a sort of, you know, a name and a date in brackets as evidence is a bit different from having tons of block quotes that kind of interrupts the flow of your argument, I think. I mean, references, I know what you mean. I mean, again, you can overdo citations and just have hundreds of people think, well, have they really read it? You know. But on the other hand, it is quite difficult to sort of, if you're making an argument in your position as an MA student, to make unsubstantiated claims that are, you know, people are thinking, well, why is he saying that? You know, he thinks it, but is it common sense, or is it something he's heard in the staff room, or did he get it from, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, it's in a way, it's the same for us, but if it's someone like Günter Kretz, you know, who's a sort of established kind of world authority in social semiotics, I guess he can get away with writing a book with no references at all, and he can just say, this is what I think. and he's earned the right to do it. You know, we'll know that when he says that, there's like this book behind it or this 10 years of research behind it, whatever, and that's okay. I mean, you know that he's evidenced it, and he kind of doesn't need to sort of keep repeating the evidence or cite anybody else because it's his own opinion. But I guess Rebecca and I still in the position where if we say something, we need to kind of back it up in some kind of way. Mm-hmm. So,
and I don't know if anyone else does this, but I did. You end up taking snippets out of books, you don't read the whole thing. So it's a case of that when you put the quote in because you think, I have read that bit in there. And you just think, in a later book, did they change their mind? Or is there a difference of opinion? It's kind of trying to support. So I do revise over a line.
So some of the difficulties, I was focusing on the future of technology and its impact in education. And it's quite easy to find lots of references. There's R&D going on at MIT, et cetera. So quite good material and what's going on, what's in the R&D stage or in the prototype stage. But finding an academic paper on it is not as easy because I'm not quite sure until it's out there in there that somebody writes about it. So that's what I'm not entirely sure of here because there's all sorts of things that I can say is happening in IT developments that and how they might be impacting education, but referencing the website on MIT where the research students got their material up is one thing, but finding somebody, didn't Neil say it takes about 2 years for a paper to get published?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So if it's 2 years for a paper to get published, somebody has to first of all do a review of the news. I did use a lot of the Future Lab stuff and the Apple. There were a few papers that like that big reports, but there's not going to be too much.
Conference presentations often go up instantly, and those are often works in progress, so those are more current.
But they're not really academic papers, are they?
Definitely cite conference presentations.
You can see quite often they become part of a referee. They're always refereed, usually. And quite often they'll be published as conference proceedings.
Right.
Sometimes with a proper book. Yeah. With an ISBN number, you know, and as Rebecca says, they often go up even sometimes in advance of the conference.
Yeah.
So that's really
But there's also professional journals, you know, where stuff, the turnaround is much quicker.
Yeah.
And, you know, if it's a report on something that you know that you think is happening in schools but hasn't filtered its way into the research yet, then professional journals are probably reporting on it, or professional conferences, or as you say, organisations like Future Lab. It'll be in the water somewhere.
And check people's websites as well. Neil puts his papers up before they're published. Sonia Livingston does as well. Mm. So some people put things up because of that time lag.
Yeah.
So it's worth, if you have some key authors, it's worth going on their websites. Yeah.
And there are conventions for citing websites and electronic sources as well there, so.
Oh, well, very nice to him. I spoke to Neil and I mentioned that some of his writings were interesting, if I could cite them. He said as long as he's not marking them. So, what he says is that the essays that we have on him, he doesn't want any of his inside it.
He's probably joking.
He said, "I highly recommend no." That's
you can't say that. If you're doing a subject that it's like it's
I refuse
and
to
you did loads of research, so you're going to be in the papers.
So I don't know.
Oh, why wouldn't Mark and I say this? It's full of quotations. Yeah, I know what you mean. I mean, there is a sort of there is a relationship with the tutor that is somehow reflected in your citations. I mean, I think it's a matter of balance. I mean, you want to recognise their work, but you don't want to make it look as if that whole thing is slavishly devoted to them because they're your tutor, you know. But I guess it's a balance. It's a bit like your examiner in a PhD, you know. When you know someone's coming to examine your viva, you know, you have to kind of, you feel as if you have to refer to their work, otherwise they're going to be put out. But it's got to not look like a tribute act, I think.
Okay, I'm going to come down with the recorder to Andrew. Do you want to continue with kind of general comments about structure and kind of relationship with tutoring?
I'll try and keep it short because I can go on forever. But if you keep writing questions and things, if I stop after about 10, 15 minutes, and then I'll stop, and then if everybody, you've all got to write a question. Nobody is allowed not to write a question, right?
even if it's kind of blindingly obvious or completely made up for my sake. Everyone must write a question about dissertations. So you can do that while I'm rabbiting on about structure here. Is that recording?
Yep.
So, I mean, if we just go through like the obvious generic elements, and I'll say a bit about those. And what for the sake of the podcast, shall I just talk uninterrupted, and then we'll come back to them afterwards and you say what you think. So, introduction. From my point of view, the introduction needs to say up front what your question is. Because if you leave that to some sort of methodology section later on, you know, whoever's reading it gets very puzzled. It's got to be clear what it is that you're basically writing about. So that has to be in the introduction. I think it's kind of also got to be clear in the introduction why it's interesting. You know, why anybody would be interested in this. Again, for the sake of your reader, but also for you. You know, why would anybody be interested in this topic? Why is it important or interesting? It's kind of enthusing people about the project, if you like. Sort of setting the flame alight a little bit. I think there's also a little bit of you in it. You know, why is it interesting for you? This is almost like a little... in PhD projects, this is what David Buckingham calls the autobiography of the thesis. You know, in a PhD thesis, you've got a bit more room to sort of tell your story and how you got to this point. You haven't really got room to do that here, but there needs to be a little bit of why is it important for you or your practice or your life or your preoccupations. Okay, end of introduction. Literature review, there's a formal requirement in the PhD. It's kind of a less formal requirement in this, but I think there has to be somewhere some sense of who has researched this topic before, what they've found, and why there's a hole that you need to fill. So there are various ways of looking at this. You can say, here are people who've written about it before, who I think have been useful and productive and inspiring and interesting, and this is how I'm going to use their work and develop it or take it further. That's one kind of group of people you can look at. There are people you can critique. They can be people who research this field who you completely don't agree with and you think have gone completely up the wrong path. So you can do a critical job and say my research will be set in opposition to this in some kind of way. And of course, as I said a minute ago, you can define unresearched space, you know, under-researched or unresearched space where there's a bit of room for you to do a bit more. You're not under the obligation that a PhD is to make an original contribution to knowledge, except, of course, that the A category in marking an MA dissertation is pretty close to that territory and does require some original contribution. It's in the marking criteria. So you need to sort of think whether you're aiming for that or not.
Sounds like it's almost unobtainable, because when you start reading, you think, yeah, oh my gosh, everyone's done research on this. But actually, as soon as you start doing research in your context, it's going to be new,
yes,
in a way, because, you know, your school is, yeah, quite unique, and, yeah, your, you know, the time that you're doing is quite unique. So it's partly about framing it, yeah, so that you make it, yeah, new and relevant. Yeah?
Yeah, there's lots of ways of doing something new. I mean, it can be new theory, which is very difficult to do. It can be a new way of approaching or researching something, or as Rebecca said, the fact that you're doing it in a new context. Anyway, that's jumping ahead of the literature review a little bit. The other things I would say about the literature review are kind of, you know, it can't really be too long in your dissertation, so don't go overboard, and don't let it get messy. You know, the more you, in a PhD, you have like a year to kind of explore the field, maybe, and get your head around it and become the international expert in it. You haven't got that luxury. I mean, you can't become the international expert in the entire field that you're looking at. You can get a broad picture of it, which you can give, but I think more important is to pluck out some very strong themes. There's an argument in the literature review. You know, these people think this, these people think that, there's a line of research that goes in this direction. You know, I'm going to situate myself here. So there needs to be like a strong story or argument in there, rather than just a blinding, confusing set of the whole field. So make it clear, you know. I mean, that's a sort of injunction about the whole dissertation, of course. Okay, so literature review. I suppose the other thing to say about the literature review is that people don't always necessarily do it up front. I mean, you may find that, you know, if you've got a very strong sense of your research falling into three parts and you've got three lots of data that you need to look at, it may be that you integrate the relevant literature with each of those three sections and discuss it as you go. Okay. I think the next section, and again, you know, this is an ideal, it may get integrated with the discussion, is you've got to have some kind of theoretical framework. You've got to be thinking, how am I conceptualizing this, how am I theorizing it? And you've got to derive that from somewhere. You can't just kind of invent the theory, you know. So you might decide, I'm talking about childhood, so I want this particular sociological theory of childhood, or I'm talking about digital media, so I've got this particular theory of, you know, digital media. But you need to borrow those from somewhere, and you need to sort of make them work for your dissertation. And I suppose, again, there, you want to not make it too complicated. You know, if you've got sort of half a dozen theories that you're trying to stick together, it just is going to be too complicated. So, this is horses for courses. You've just got to decide what you need, but you have to spell it out. What's the way in which you're conceptualizing the data? What will be the way, the framework you use to explain what you found? And it's something you've got to come back to at the end. I think one fault with dissertations you often see, and PhD theses as well, is, you know, there's this really elaborate theoretical structure up front, and then you never hear about half of it again. You know, you get to the end and you think, well, what was all that stuff about identity they said in chapter two? You know, they've never come back to it. So whatever the theory is, it's got to work for you, and you've got to keep it running, and you've got to make sure at the end that you've used it. And if you haven't used it, take those bits out, you know. So theory, then methodology. So you know, you've got a question, you've had a look at what everyone else has said about it, or some other people anyway. You've got a kind of theory that will help you to think about it. Then how are you going to research it? So this is where all the stuff about research design is. Yours a case study, or is it a quantitative survey, or is it an ethnography, or is it action research, a kind of classroom intervention? What kind of research is it? You need to say there. And within that, you need to explain clearly how you've gone about getting your data and why you've done it that way, why you've chosen particular samples of students, and how you've managed that, what sorts of data you're looking for exactly as evidence. I mean, there is the sort of...
Sorry.
Oh, yeah, ethics. Sorry. I beg your pardon. Yeah, we keep reminding me, because I will, as you can see, I'm going to forget about ethics. There is this sort of triangulation idea, you know. You may want to think, well, I'm looking for different kinds of data that will somehow speak to each other or tell a stronger story than if I only had one kind of data. So in our media, funny media world, you know, we're often thinking, I've got classroom observation and I've got interviews with kids and I've got the videos that they made, and that's three kinds of data, and if they all come together and tell the same story, then I'm in a very strong position to make a claim about the evidence. If they contradict each other, I'm going to have to think why that is. So data collection. Now, traditionally there's a distinction between method and methodology. And this is a really difficult area, actually. PhD students often get very confused about this, so don't worry if you're confused as well. I mean, I'm still confused. Don't put this on the internet.
You're going to be quoted.
Yeah, my global claim to be confused about method and methodology.
That's right, it's a private jelly class.
Private. Okay, so, you know, method is traditionally how you do it, the practicality. Methodology is, if you like, the theory of this. The theory that you use for your data collection and analysis. So if you say, I'm going to have a sample of children that represent a particular socio-economic group, there's a theory there about, you know, the social construction of groups in schools or whatever. If you say, I'm going to do an ethnographic semi-structured interview, there's a theory in ethnographic practice about how interviews work and what they mean about the constitution of knowledge, or the interaction between researcher and researched, and so on. There's a theory there. You know, it's not just, I'm going to ask some questions. More importantly, I think, though, is the methodology of interpretation. So I've got these groups, I've got this situation, I'm doing actual research, I've collected this data, how am I going to interpret it? you know. So it's not just about your theoretical framework, you know, I'm going to interpret it in terms of identity and childhood. It's about what are you going to do with those words that you've transcribed or those photographs you've taken? How are you going to analyse those? This is quite difficult, and quite often people, I have to say, don't actually analyse them. They just draw conclusions and discuss them loosely. I mean, a lot of research does that, even by professional researchers. But I guess we would say that you need to say, well, I'm going to kind of look at the language they use, and I'm going to think about it carefully, and I'm going to think about the structures that they employ. This would be discourse analysis for us, which is a favourite way of looking at, in fact, what other way would there be to look at interview data? Or if you've got visual material, are you using some kind of method of visual analysis to think about what it's telling you? This is the methodological theory. So, you know, you might say, I mean, for us, you might say, I've got a theory of identity and childhood here, and I've got a theory of social semiotics here, which is how I'm going to analyse my data, or whatever it might be. So it's two different types of theory. One that's used to explain the social or educational phenomenon you're looking at, and then one in methodology that's to do with how do I analyse my data.
I mean, this is different. Really kind of basic level, it's kind of like whether the question is how do you see children's talk? Are you going to take it at face value, or are you seeing it as something that's produced in a social context? So your analysis, your theory of analysis, is that you actually have to analyse the social context of that talk. So you need to think about, you know, is it a female interviewee interviewing a group of 10-year-old girls, which produces a certain kind of positioning by the interviewee, so that talk that they're doing has a social meaning and social purpose to it. So that's a just kind of really brief example of how you might explain that your analysis is going further than taking talk at face value. You're looking at social context, and you're seeing talk as something that people embed with meanings and use to position themselves in particular ways.
It's quite hard, this. I mean, and it's hard, you know, even for PhD students, again, I mean, if they're basically a sociologist or whatever, they may not know enough about linguistics to do discourse analysis at the sort of grammatical level. And you're probably all in the same boat, you know. It's too much. I mean, but at least, as Rebecca said, you could say, I'm going to look carefully at the kind of language they use. I'm not going to take it at face value. I'm going to think about the social context, and I'm going to, you know, treat it as complex data that I need to sort of, you know, think carefully about. I mean, even just to say that is worth saying, I think. Okay, so we've got method and methodology. Keep this brief. This really doesn't need to be long, you know. Couple of pages. Ethics. Part of that section needs to be your ethical approach. You know about this. You've filled in a form, haven't you? No?
Yes, everyone who's done my methods course will have filled in a form. Very good. Or is about to fill in a form. So you fill in another one for your dissertation project. Yeah? And then you should get approval from the MA teams. And that you include that in your dissertation, and just again a paragraph, what you considered, and that you received approval from the IRB.
Definitely. Now, the meat of that, this is like the bread in the sandwich, the bit I've just described, right? The first bit of bread, and then the meat, or the vegetarian filling, is your data and the discussion of it. And curiously, although this is the bulk of your thesis, it's the hardest for me to say much about, because it's just going to be so different from person to person. I mean, all you can say is that you have to show that you've kind of approached it systematically. You can't just kind of witter about it. And you have to have said what that systematic approach will be in the methodology bit. You have to have an argument. You know, it isn't... I guess there are two ways of doing this. I mean, there's a convention in more scientifically orientated research to have analysis followed by discussion. And you've probably read journal articles that are structured like this. You know, so you have a section that's very descriptive, you know, where this is the data, and there may be some analysis as well, formal analysis, but it's not trying to explain anything or interpret anything. And then you've got this session called discussion. It's like something in The Lancet, you know, and then there's this sort of what does it mean, how do I interpret it, what are the implications for practice and all the rest of it, like a follow-on section. In media and cultural research, it tends not to be like that. The analysis tends to be integrated with the discussion. So there's like an argument going along as you go, and bits of data are reduced as evidence for the sections of the argument. So it'll kind of depend what you're doing and what you want to do, you know, and the nature of your data and how you're processing it. Do you have a whole load of stuff to analyse and then you think about it theoretically, or do you have an argument, a story to tell, and an argument to go with it that will unfold over a series of sections, and you'll use bits of evidence as you go through?
I mean, I think the most common, challenge, I guess, is to go beyond the description of your data. And sometimes I'll start. I mean, and it's also, you know it has to be half your dissertation. This is the bulk of it, and it can be intimidating to start. And sometimes, so I'll start with a description, and just that act of describing, you know, this tiny bit of data actually then kind of evolves into a more analytical frame. So be thinking that actually it takes time to get to that level, you know, beyond the description.
Yeah, and I think probably there's a question there about what do you do first? I mean, how do you go about doing this? Because, I mean, I'm describing like an ideal sequence, but that's not the sequence you would write it in. I mean, quite often with my students, I begin with the bit chunks of data and say, well, let's write about these for a bit first to see what you're thinking about or how you would describe it to me or how we would start to theorise it, because that's the most important bit. And then kind of go back and fill in the other bits later. But again,
yeah, I mean, in terms of your timeline, which we'll get to after this, leave that one of the major hints from all the tutors is leave enough time to do your analysis. So don't get, you really need to get through your literature review and your data collection quickly, so that you allow yourself enough time for the analysis. Because, I mean, if you're aiming for September 1st, the deadline for drafts is end of July, because often we're away for at least 2 weeks, some of us 4 weeks of August, so you really, really do need to meet that draft deadline. And the more you have written, the better. Yeah. So, and often students will have students get through everything except the analysis on their draft. And that's really kind of, that's the hardest part. It's the most crucial part. So don't leave that to the end.
Yeah. It's a commonplace observation of empirical research that it's very easy to generate data, very difficult to analyze it. And you don't need much data, actually.
No.
For an MA dissertation or even for a PhD.
Yeah.
I mean, less is more, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. I had six students I followed for my PhD. Six students in my own. I was a primary school teacher. Mm-hmm. I followed my students for a year. Their story writing practices. And in the end, I only wrote about six of them. Mm-hmm. And that was over 100,000 words. Yeah. So you really do not need a lot of data.
And you haven't got much time to collect it if you're going to process it properly. A problem that we're finding with our current research project, but which we'll tell you about someday.
Some of you have heard about it.
Oh, right, you've heard about it.
And the cat who came and sat on my lap. The 6-year-old who decided instead of reflecting on her play, she would be a cat and come and sit on my lap.
So that's it, apart from the conclusion. And in the conclusion, it's actually strange how people miss conclusions off, you know. I mean, I can remember several draft dissertations where they get to the end of the discussion, it just stops dead, you know. There is no, I'm writing back saying, where's the conclusion? What have you decided? So this is, it's obvious, but it's worth saying, you need to go back to your original question. You need to decide, have I answered it? And if I have answered it, what am I saying? You need to go back to the theory and think, well, have I really employed that theoretical framework? And if so, you know, how am I using that in answering the question? And if that doesn't work, you know, there's some fixing to do up front and throughout, probably.
Yeah, so, again, that circular, messy process. Yeah. So, I mean, people do change their research question or their whole, you know, by the time you get to the end of your analysis, you might tweak the question because actually your data was pointed to something really interesting that you hadn't considered, and your analysis kind of really drew out some different kinds of questions. So keep going back to your literature review. And
you're lucky, you've got word processors. I did a mini thesis option as part of my finals for my degree in 1975, right, on Ted Hughes, and I had to type it. No, I had to write it, and then I had to give it to a typist to type out. So it was like one draft, you know, and then some corrections.
Okay, I'm collecting questions.
Enough. Let's have some questions. You've all got to write a question. Yeah, those of you who haven't written, we'll start with these two. It's just not good enough. Right. Now, these are anonymous, so you don't need to be embarrassed. Are we still recording this, Rebecca?
Yeah, go on. People like to hear you Twitter.
Well, I mean, I think we should open these up to discussion.
Anyone else?
Can I... Yeah. Can I analyse data using a different method to mine in my dissertation if the data isn't my own? Oh, I see what you mean. Okay. So if somebody else has gathered some data, can you use raw data that someone else has collected in your own dissertation? Is that the question? This is going to identify who wrote the question. Is that what you meant? If someone else has got some raw data, can you borrow it and reinterpret it?
Yeah. So in addition to me collecting some data, one point you made less is more.
Yeah.
And can I use data that hasn't been analysed by anybody?
Yeah. Which someone else has collected.
Which somebody else has collected.
Yes, you can. I mean, you have to attribute it, of course. Yeah. I mean, you have to not pretend it's yours. But I mean, in fact, in empirical research, there's not enough, actually, use of previously collected raw data. And one of the things the research councils always claim to do is to kind of store this stuff so that future researchers can look at it again. Because we often only sort of look at a minute proportion of it in these projects. So there's a huge amount of raw data sitting around that goes unanalyzed. So I think it's a good thing to do that. I mean, I think you've just got to make a decision about what part it's playing in your, you know, it presumably means that a bigger claim for your academic work is going to be interpretation and argument and all the rest of it, rather than data collection.
Previous years' data in a similar topic.
Yeah.
So, sort of, hopefully it's saying the same stuff as I'm about to do.
Yeah, well, if it isn't, that's also interesting. Okay, do we need to include quantitative data within the dissertation, or can we use only qualitative? What do you think? What's the answer?
Both, if you wish.
Both.
One says both, one says both.
Or one or the other.
Any other offers? There is no right answer. I'm just looking for opinions. What's the advantage of using both, would you say?
One supports the other.
Yeah.
One can give you a kind of objective snapshot of what's happening, and the other can, in the qualitative, is a little bit better at finding out what people are thinking or why they're doing things. You might not necessarily get that from the quantitative. Mm. So they can tackle the same problem from two different angles.
Makes it more complete.
Yeah.
I think.
More thorough, a more rounded picture, yeah. I mean, this is all fine, yeah. I think it's also to do with the claim that you're making about the, about your data. I mean, if you're claiming that you're proving something, it's quite hard to do that with qualitative data. If you're proving it in a generalizable, so there's these technical things about generalizability as well. With qualitative data, the claim people would often make is that the results are suggestive, you know, rather than conclusive proof of something, you know. But, I mean, they're not just suggestive on their own, they're usually suggestive because they're connected with a tradition of research which is saying similar things, you know. So you're connecting it with a line of inquiry. Other people have found this in other studies, and I'm adding my study to it. Because it's often things that can't be proved or disproved. That's why you're investigating them qualitatively. You know, if you want to find out whether more boys than girls read computer magazines. You can prove that, and you can prove it with a questionnaire. If you want to prove that that's a valuable aspect of their literacy practices, you can't prove that. You can make an argument for it using qualitative data, and your argument will be more or less convincing, depending on how you make it and how you interpret it and how you situate it in the wider field of literacy studies. So it depends what you're trying to find and what you're trying to claim, I think. And that's partly what the qualitative-quantitative relation is about. Rebecca, what do you think?
I would be fine with dissertations that are entirely qualitative, but an entirely quantitative dissertation, given that we've taught you social research methods and really done a lot of work on mixed methods, I would say if you're doing a survey, you know, I would expect at least one or two open-ended questions as well. And that's mixed.
That's qualitative.
That's qualitative.
Yeah.
So it's not that you can't do a survey and that's going to be your data. It's just I would say I would expect some open-ended questions in the survey.
I think that's right. I mean, I think it's the quantitative stuff tells you stuff that's interesting in some respects. I mean, it's interesting because it gives you a big picture that you can't get from a focus group. But it's at a certain level. I think I agree with Rebecca. She said it in a nutshell. You were going to say something.
So, yeah, I was going to say, if we could kind of move to the secondary data that's sort of been collected.
Yeah, of what kind?
Don't know. But, I mean, so something that's already been collected and analysed, can we use that to sort of back up some sort of...
Yeah, I think part of what you're doing is making an argument, and I mean, how it connects, as I said, with earlier research is part of your claim, I think. I mean, I used to do some reviewing for this thing called the Epicentre at the Institute, which is... evidence-based policy and practice initiative. It comes out of a way of reviewing health articles, actually, for doctors and hospitals, where they need to be able to say, well, you know, there are, you know, 65 studies of verrucas, and, you know, if you put them all together, they discover that the best way to treat a verruca is by putting duct tape on it. I know this because I've read them all, but, you know, so they haven't got time to read the 65 studies. What they want is a synthesis. But when the people who do the synthesis don't just say, well, you boil it all together and it tells this story, they make a judgment about which of the bits of research are qualitatively better. And one of the things they'll say is the argument robust? And part of what they mean by that is it related to other arguments in the literature? You can't just make up an argument out of nowhere. It has to connect. It's a dialogic process. It connects with other things you've read. So when you say, so if you can find other people who've said a similar thing and you're adding your voice to that, of course that becomes a stronger argument, you know. Sorry, I've got distracted from the questions. Oh God, I hope we get through all these now, having asked you all to write one. We'll have to do postings. Constantly, what are the common weaknesses in writing up a dissertation? Wow, that's a good one. What do you think they are?
Well, the description, I mean, are you asking?
No, I'm asking them, yeah.
Sorry.
I mean, we have dropped some heavy hints, so I know you haven't marked a whole load of them, but you probably have some idea, don't you?
Not answering the question that you have set up to answer.
Yes, or not producing a clear question in the first place anyway, yeah. That's very common. Not having a clear question or not answering it are really common weaknesses.
Focus, yeah.
Mm.
Plagiarism.
Yeah, plagiarism is, yeah. I mean, it's not that common, fortunately, in a very obvious form, but where it does crop up, it's...
Stats. I was shocked when we did that on a lesson.
We did a paper, didn't we?
Mm.
Yeah, up to 30% or something.
Was that the students that had plagiarised?
I'm not sure if that was essays or the dissertation, but it was really high.
On which... Where? At the IOE?
In Wales somewhere, the University of Wales.
Oh, yeah. Or maybe that's where he got the data from, yeah.
The trouble is, when people set out to research this, they usually want to tell a drastic story, which means that they set the sort of definition of what counts as plagiarism very high, I think. I mean, you know, would that 30% really be people who are literally lifting verbatim great chunks out of other people's work?
Good mention
or would be people who... you know, might
use quotations right.
Well, I might have made a reference to an idea and not kind of attributed it properly. Do you know what I mean?
It's what plagiarism is.
Yeah, I'm worried about that with my essays if I haven't got the quotations right. Have I done it?
I mean, the thing is, we do devise our essay questions, so it's harder to plagiarize them because they're not general essay questions. And your dissertation is going to be your question, you know. I mean, yeah, there are paragraphs you could ostensibly lift. But when you're analyzing your data, it has to be linked to, you know, you have an image that you're analyzing, you know. Mm. So we make it harder.
Well, no, I think it is harder, yeah. But it is a fuzzy category. I mean, all I would say is play safe, really. Or ask your, discuss it with your supervisor. Yeah. Other common weaknesses? Incoherence?
I mean, I think the biggest thing is
weak arguments, fuzzy arguments,
kind of
too descriptive.
Describing rather than analyzing. And that's hard to even tell you what that means, but we'll keep, you know, that's part of the role of your tutor, is to make sure you go deeper, deeper, deeper. And also the kind of, just the kind of critical edge, you know. So even in the literature review, rather than going and saying, this is what this person said, this is what this person said, this is what this person said, you know, actually your job is to synthesize it and pull it together, critique it. Yeah?
Yeah. Other common weaknesses? Academic style is a sort of interesting one, you know. I mean, being able to write in a way that's kind of... I mean, there is actually an assessment criterion for this, you know, at the end, writing clearly and coherently and lucidly and all the rest of it. And it is partly just a technical thing, I mean, writing clearly and getting your message across. But it is a stylistic thing as well. It's about, you know, developing a kind of academic voice, which is, you know, on the one hand, sounds kind of reasonably objective and professional, and as if you're sort of speaking in the same language as the field of study that you're working within. But it's also about not overdoing it and not using jargon and not writing impenetrably and not using French philosophers too much.
On that subject, I noticed the contrast between these two dissertations. One uses the first person, it seemed quite a lot, and the other uses the passive voice a lot more. And it is, I would be inclined to use the passive voice, but I suppose it could sound a bit pompous.
Well, it used to be a cast iron rule, and now it isn't anymore. I think people are much more tolerant now of using the first person. So I think it's kind of okay, as long as it doesn't begin to sound confessional or autobiographical, you know? I think, you know, it's your theory, and it's your suggestion, and it's fine to say, I did this in the classroom, and, you know, I've read these things, but my belief is that this is the case. I think it's kind of okay. And it sounds a bit more human.
Chapters,
you know?
You have voices as well. You know, so you're working for your methodology section, especially when you're talking through your methods, you might use first person. You know, so, but, you know, as long as you're not switching back and forth within a paragraph or within a page, you know, you kind of have a clear. But yeah, it's fine to use first person generally.
That's probably enough on weaknesses, isn't it? Otherwise we'll get depressed. Now, I've got a really good question here. What is education?
The reason I asked
that... Fair No, it's an interesting one. I mean,
the reason I asked that is I've got a couple strong ideas where I've got some clear ideas where I could get the data. I've got tons of data at work, and so I could do digital divide, and I could look at the effect of education technology on their overall outcome and analyse the data and stuff. But I've got another area that I'm kind of interested in, which kind of borders that a bit, and it's looking at IT overload. There was a study that I just downloaded today that was just out in the press about the number of hours that they're spending online, but how that affects young people and students, being exposed to a lot of violence and sex on the internet at young ages, but even more importantly, not being present, because I also have some interest in mindfulness-based therapies and stress reduction, and I know that they're starting to do a lot in schools, but I haven't found out what they're doing in schools yet to try and tackle the fact that your consciousness is constantly being taken because you're talking all the time. And also a little bit of a crossover what I mentioned to you last night, the idea of memes, and there's been some research done on memes where your idea of the world is affected by all this information that's coming into you. And I could possibly call that informal learning, because it is a type of learning. And that's why I'm saying, what is education? Because I think there's probably enough research been done in these areas for me to probably tackle it. It might be difficult, but probably tackle it in a coherent manner. But I'm not quite sure if it will meet the requirements of ICT in education, because it is pretty much, it's perhaps maybe too much informal education, because the types of things that they're doing, not just in school, but also from 3 o'clock when school ends till 2 o'clock in the morning, whatever time they're now going to bed, and that constant...
Who is your supervisor?
I have it in an email.
Well, I think this is one to discuss with your supervisor, but I mean, it seems to me the critical distinctions between learning and education. You know, whatever you do in life, you're going to learn from, but it's not necessarily education implies a kind of pedagogic intervention.
Yeah, we just
right, and that can be in the formal or in the informal sector, or even in the home or in an internet community. As long as someone's setting out to structure your learning in some way, that sounds to me like education.
I think this linked really nicely to our final topic, which is the role of the tutor.
Ah,
yeah.
So should we move on to that now? Yeah.
That
I'm sorry if you've got questions you haven't answered, but if you want to give them to me and Rebecca, we can send you emails responses. But in that case, maybe write your name and email address on the back. Yeah. Okay. So last topic, yeah?
Yeah?
Role of the tutor. Who's talking about this?
Oh, would you like to chip in? I'll kind of
I don't mind.
Yeah?
Yeah, sure.
So, I mean, I think, you know, Peter, it's quite important for you to kind of start, if you're going to, you know, try to meet a September 1st deadline, to really start focusing, yeah? So, and your tutor will help you do that. I mean, it's partly, I mean, particularly I think more in media and cultural studies, because the Media Cultural Studies MA is drawing on particular theories, and that's why we do the core module first, is because there are a set of theories that really we expect you at least to give a nod to, if not drawing, you know, so there is a kind of body of theories that we're drawing on. With the MAICT in education, it's much broader, but still your tutor will help you distinguish partly between kind of populist writing and academic writing, partly between, you know, kind of writing that is in a field that is only tangentially related to, you know, ICT and education. So they'll help you focus your reading, yeah, but also help you focus your topic and kind of develop that kind of coherent thread throughout your dissertation. So bringing that sheet that I handed out, that I will email to you all who are listening to this podcast, really helps you start thinking through. I mean, it's really just to get some rough ideas down on paper to help you start thinking through this narrative of your dissertation, you know, starting with your kind of topic and questions, leading through to literature connected to it, which leads to the kinds of your question and your data. What kind of data are you going to collect to help you answer your research question? And then, okay, well, where are you going to get your data? What's convenient? Are you going to do convenient sampling? Are you going to do purposive sampling? What will you need in order to achieve that? How are you going to manage your data? You know, and is this going to be achievable in the 6 months that you have? Yeah, so taking this to your first meeting will help you kind of get the big picture so you can start breaking it down. So I think the next step then, I usually have my tutee start with a literature review, and I really try to keep a deadline on that so it doesn't become the first 3 months, because you really do need to kind of get on to your data collection so you have enough time to collect your data, but mainly to analyze your data. So I really help suggest readings, but also break that literature review down into sections, so structuring that chapter is the next thing. Going through methods and the different considerations for methods, and thinking ahead to how are you going to analyze, especially with surveys, you know, really thinking very carefully about how you're going to answer your question, you know, getting the data in order to answer your question. And then, yeah, kind of constant contact while collecting data, because lots of questions will come up. So I think
yeah, that. And then I, you know, then I usually sit down with my tutees and start going through the raw data and just kind of demonstrating how you might, you know, what themes seem to be popping out to me, and how you kind of go through that process of, you know, an initial layer of analysis, and then, you know, talking through how, what themes are coming out, and then what literature you might draw on to further explain those themes, and just kind of going through the process. So I like to really get chunks of writing from my tutees. So I have the literature review. That's you know, you've got your whatever 4,000 words, and that's written, and I've proofread that for you. I've, you know, given you comments. So when I see the final thing at the end of July, I've actually read the literature review already. So actually my job in July is to read the whole thing and suggest how you might tie the whole thing together. Yeah. So submitting chunks of writing in advance of your meetings is really the most helpful thing to you. And it'll produce the most productive discussions during your meetings. What else would you say about the tutor?
Well, I mean, I would try and schedule it. Did you mention that? I would try and draw up a schedule with them over the period of time you've got, with some deadlines in it. I mean, I've got a student I'm tutoring at the moment, and I said to her, look, my dates are going to disappear if we don't get them in the diary. So we put... You're entitled, supposedly, to 5 meetings with your tutor, so we put 5 dates in the diary at the beginning, which meant that she had deadlines to get various bits to me by, and I knew that they're in the diary, and that helped enormously. I think it's not always possible to do that. I mean, sometimes you have to be a bit more flexible, and it depends who your tutor is, but it's quite nice to plan it all a bit in advance. Otherwise, you might find you don't get the number of meetings you're entitled to, or they arrive at the wrong time, or they all get bunched up at the end, or whatever. So it's worth thinking about that. I think the other thing generally to say about it is that in master's degrees, you know, the sort of international criteria for what counts as a master's degree, or the European criteria anyway, specifically mention autonomy and independence of study as a kind of criterion for MA-ness, you know? So unlike in an undergraduate degree, you're expected to be more independent as a researcher and more autonomous. Now, it's obviously a matter of degree. I mean, you're not expected to be as autonomous as a PhD researcher, so it's fine for you to have more support and more structure and more help. But, you know, a certain amount of it you have to do on your own, of course. Mm-hmm. So I guess that relationship with the tutor reflects that. They'll expect you to be doing the main job, and they're there to support and help you through it, you know? Which seems obvious for anyone when you say it like that, but there we are.
Okay. 6:28, 2 minutes. Any last questions?
If you're quoting from a conference paper, where you've got loads of writers, some of them as little as one sheet of paper, are you allowed to quote from them as well?
Are these like conference abstracts or something like that, do you mean?
Okay, like this one is a conference paper, CA, Computer Assisted Assessment.
Oh, some of them are very brief papers, aren't they?
Yeah, very, very,
very
brief.
Short paper.
You've got just about... a sheet or two as their presentation.
Yeah, I think you can, yeah. It's conference proceedings, yeah. This is technically called the grey literature, unpublished stuff, you know. Mm-hmm. Conference proceedings, PhD and MA dissertations. So if it's there and you've got it, you can cite it, yeah, and okay. You can quote from it. Can't you?
Yeah.
There you go.
How far are you allowed for your personal opinion?
In the whole thing?
Yeah.
You're allowed your personal opinion, but I mean, it has to be the product of an argument, an analysis, or a piece of evidence, you know. What you can't have is unsupported personal opinions.
You have to earn the right to say something, basically, yep. You know. I mean, one of my most common kind of comments as I go through students' work as evidence, question mark. You know, I just, that's one of my, I should have a little function key, you know, F4, evidence, question mark, evidence, question mark. It's really common to have unsupported statements. But that's a rule, again, that's a rule of you too. I mean, like Peter was saying, it's a fine balance. Some things are obvious, you know, like you said, the overhead projector thing, you know. Mm. Some things you probably don't need evidence for, but other things you do.
It's not really personal opinion either. I mean, technically speaking, it's a hypothesis. I mean, it's an objectively framed idea. So I think there's a distinct, you know, so for instance, if you take your area of, you know, I'm not quite sure whether that's what you were saying, but I mean, you know, the popular supposition that children have information overload and it somehow decreases their attention span, right, and they can't concentrate in school anymore, okay? Well, that's a popular opinion. And if you sort of went around saying, oh, bloody hell, you know, kids can't concentrate in school anymore, it's all the fault of the internet, well, that's a personal opinion, and you wouldn't want it in an MA dissertation. But it seems reasonable to me to frame a hypothesis that says, well, you know, kids do have access to more information than they've ever had before. It's in a wide variety of modes and forms. It's very kind of spectacularly presented. What effect does that have on, you know, the nature of their learning? Does it mean they learn more, or does it mean they're confused by the variety? To set up a hypothesis and then come back to it at the end and say, well, what does my evidence tell me? That's fine. I think the worry is when people have got a personal bee in their bonnet, you know, and that they present it as a hypothesis, but you read the thing, you know all the way along that they just believe this and they're going to bloody well prove it, whatever happens, you know. And then at the end, surprise, surprise, they say, well, I was right all along, you know. And, okay, you know, maybe there's a sort of superficial attempt to kind of deploy some data to prove what you know they've already made their mind up about, but, you know, that shows, I think.
But that, again, is the role of the person to, that's why you should have a first meeting, which, you know, and your tutor will say, well, actually, there's a problem with you approaching it that way, but you could approach it this way.
Hmm. A bit like evolution versus creationist argument.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think you've just got to be open-minded about these things. I mean, it's difficult because, of course, people want to investigate things that are of interest to them, and usually you will have an opinion about it, of course. You know, you're not going to be completely, well, it could be this, it could be that, but I think it's your duty to sort of be open-minded about it and to honestly assess what the evidence tells you. Yeah.
And those assumptions are coming from someplace. Our assumptions about children in media are coming from theories about, you know, from media and cultural studies. And so we do have assumptions, but, you know, it's partly about recognizing your assumptions and then finding where they come from and what theories help explain those
critically
assumptions.
Assessing.
And kind of, you know, you don't come to your study as a blank slate.
Yeah.
So it's recognizing where your ideas, how your ideas are framing your research questions.
Mm.
Sorry, last one probably. Before you get the question approved, do we just email it to the tutor before, and then they approve it, or
there should be a proposal form?
Yeah, so yeah. When the proposal comes, we just send it off to the tutor.
Send it to Brigitte.
Okay.
I think.
Yeah, and it should.
Well, actually, but where are the ICT MA works differently.
Yes.
So actually, no, send it to your tutor. Sorry. The media MA, you have a personal tutor, and then you'll be assigned a dissertation tutor when you're, but yours is probably different. Yours will probably be Lisbeth in any case. So. But the ICT MA, your personal tutor, is your dissertation tutor, unless we think that we can't handle your topic, you know, unless the topic really is related to
someone else's specialism.
Yeah. Okay.
Good.
Any suggestion for bibliographic software?
Oh, EndNote.
EndNote. You can get a cheap.
Yeah. Information Services in the library and SPSS. What is the latest on buying SPSS from?
I'm working at the university, so.
Oh right. Okay. Okay.
So, yeah,
but Information Services sells student license that are limited in length or something. So EndNote for bibliography, SPSS for quantitative data.
Yeah. And so check classes. Although actually you can work on that.